Hi. Could you present yourself?
My name's Ray. I live in the desert in Arizona and part of the Catalyst Info Shop. It's been around for about 5 years, and through that, I'm doing various projects, one of them including some volunteer work with an organization called Black Mesa Indigenous Support.
Could you tell us more about the struggle with the Navajo up there?
Well, Black Mesa Indigenous Support came out of the need for non-Native supporters to have a more solidified role in their resistance to relocation. In 1977, there was a Hopi Land Settlement Act that was passed that was basically said that the land that over 12,000 Navajo or Diné folks were living on were now Hopi, and a lot of this has direct ties with resource extraction, specifically coal. Peabody Coal Mine is the largest coal mining company in the world, and the land that is NPL, Navajo Partition Land, and HPL, Hopi Partition Land, is one of the largest coal reserves in the world. And there was definitely a relocation. Diné folks relocated, not so much at their will, but largely due to force and confrontation. And there were also, and still continues to be to this day, resistors to that relocation, most of them being elders. Every day they wake up is a direct action against the government, and specifically Hopi police that have the, quote, authority to kick them off land that they have their umbilical cords buried in, land that was inherited to them from their elders. And so the support structure for what BMIS, or Black Mesa Indigenous Support, looks like serves two functions. One of them is the website, blackmesais.org, which, if you go on it, is over hundreds of pages of information, historical information about the relocation historically, both like within the late 1800s and then also the Hopi Land Settlement Act and the resistance to relocation that happened on that from Native and non-Native perspectives. Also current updates about Stop Peabody Coal, and then also current issues that involve police confrontation or sort of hot button alerts that occur upon the land. That information needs to get out to a larger audience. The other function that BMIS serves is getting direct on-land support to elders, which are the first priority, and families that are still resisting relocation that have not signed accommodation agreements and that are asking for support. And that support looks like anything from sheep herding to corn planting to chopping wood to hauling water, and just basically like serving the needs of the families that are still up there.
Could you talk a little bit more about the historical displacement or the historical repression of the Diné people?
Yeah, I don't have the specific dates in front of me. The first relocation that occurred with the Navajo or Diné, I use the word Diné as a way to honor the Navajo folks that prefer to be called Diné, which is the word for people in Navajo language. Navajo is a colonized word. There was, after a three-year battle and war between the frontierman Kit Carson and his large posse, this huge feud, he rounded up thousands of Diné, and there was the longest walk, which I believe was in 1867, to a land partitioned out in New Mexico. And this was a horrific event, and many people died. Many Navajo or Diné didn't make it. In the Navajo language, there is no word for relocation. It just basically means to like no longer exist. The culture is so intertwined with the land that the culture is permanently altered. And that's why a lot of folks refer to this land struggle as cultural genocide, as a matter of cultural survival, because this land is Diné. This land is the culture. So that was the first time they were relocated from their land, and that was, I think, over a 400 mile walk. Years later, they were, quote, allowed to return after thousands had died, dwindling like the population of the Diné people significantly, and those initial wounds had been opened up between trust and what it meant to give in to any type of like white power. And so they were back up on their land a few years later, and while they were away, like, white settlers definitely knew that there was coal reserves in this land, and there was a prominent Mormon and high up in the government official who was a lawyer, and also had his fingers in coal mining, and Peabody coal specifically. And basically what happened is, before the creation of tribal councils, it was pretty hard to negotiate any sort of deals with tribes and reservations because it was still like traditional spiritual elders, and it was, the process was complicated. So as a way to create more of a fast-track approach to resource extraction on these lands, which are completely rich with resources, the tribal council was formed, and he originally went to the Navajo people and started to ask if he could create these deals, and they resisted and they wouldn't cooperate with him at all. So he went to Hopi, which is the neighboring tribe, and he gained access onto their tribal council. And that was a way for that first bridge to be made between access. So 1966 or 1964, again, I don't have the dates in front of me, the first coal mine was opened, Black Mesa coal mine. And in 1977 is when the Hopi Land Settlement Act was put into place legally, which said, well, basically what it was is through this puppet government allowing the relocation of over 12,000 Dene folks who were living on land that, again, had been inherited from like generations within their family, to be relocated so that they could, and then that land was actually deemed HPL, or Hopi Partition Land, which was a coal bed and a coal seam. Completely rich in coal, and so that they could continue to mine and keep the mine open. And that sort of tails up with the previous conversation about that time. As soon as the act, the Land Settlement Act, they didn't start enforcing it until like the early 80s. And that's when the film Broken Rainbow came out. That's when there was a huge global solidarity movement, and a lot of people were organizing and supporting and resisting in that. Very much elder-led, elders marching on the White House. There was occupations and blockades of the mine itself, and then shortly after, there was always an informal support for resistors, and then the formal formation of Black Mesa Indigenous Support.
Can you tell us more about
more of the history of how Dene people and non-Native people created relationships and links, and eventually led to the creation of the BMIS?
Yeah, I can't speak too much to it because I wasn't there. And I moved to the desert about a year and a half ago, and have only been familiar with these issues for about a year and a half. But I do know that the creation of Black Mesa Indigenous Support was acknowledging that there is a space for like non-Native organizers to be involved in resistance and struggle. And a lot of that is by showing up for years and being a presence. And then finally those spaces will be carved out. And I feel like Black Mesa Indigenous Support was one of those organizations and formations where it was folks who had already been dedicated to being in solidarity with the resistance for years, and finally formally created BMIS as a way for more folks who didn't have experience or knowledge with the resistance to be able to plug in. And it was a role that was asked of by the elders and by the Native people. And it's always a fine line to navigate as to the intricacies of that. And like BMIS has been doing a really detailed job of, even when supporters come onto the land to support, anyone that goes through BMIS is again representing that organization. And so there's a huge packet that folks are encouraged to read. It's a cultural sensitivity packet that lays out pages and pages of things that folks might not otherwise know, especially if they're going out to the land for the first time. And then there's also a huge chunk that was just added on pretty recently, collectively edited by folks involved with BMIS, about challenging white supremacy and what organizing, Native and non-Native organizing, can look like, and what things might come up and what folks are doing to like challenge that within themselves before they ever step foot on the land.
And how do you see your participation as a non-Native to that struggle?
I think it's one of those things where this specific instance, like this cultural survival story, is one example of what's happening throughout the world. And it's not just about like keeping Indigenous voice alive. It's like we are all bound to that. Like the survival of Indigenous ways and Indigenous tribes and Indigenous land is linked to us all, whether we realize it or not. I have white skin privilege. I'm perceived as white. I also have my great-grandmother, who is the eldest living Salish Coastal Tribal member. She was born on the res and she'll die on the res. And so I, growing up, only knew about this story. She was born on the res and raised in residential schools until she was 18 years old. And so this is the type of U.S. history that my family knows. And so for me, it's very easy to connect those dots wherever I am and wherever I'm living to Indigenous struggle and look who was on that land before me. And that struggle is a complete microcosm for the pulse of organizing, and that's where I need to put my attention at.
Would you feel comfortable telling us about how you got implicated or how you got involved in the BMAS?
Sure. Every year there's a big convergence on the land for folks to get involved. It's like a Thanksgiving run. Usually it's a food supply that's organized by a band and a group of people out in California. And they come every year to the land. They've been doing this for like over almost 20 years now. And so when I first moved to Arizona, I heard about the resistance to relocation by someone who had, an elder in my community in Prescott who had been up to Black Mesa to participate in the 30-year resistance convergence, festival time. Everyone came together and just acknowledged that it had been 30 years and that there are still elders fighting out that had started in the beginning and that are still here at the end. And just that simple story, that one story, someone telling it to one other person, got a whole room full of people. We organized that night of what that was going to look like, and we took almost everyone that was in that room that had heard about that story, that had never heard about the resistance before, up to the land for Thanksgiving. And just met up with some organizers and realized what a bare bones operation that BMIS really is, and that any help that folks can give, it does definitely takes like a solid committed group of people, but a lot of those folks live on the land at like many months out of the year themselves, and that's how those relationships are sustained. It's not about organizing. Like, organizing is relationship building. That's what it is. And if you're going to be effective at anything, like, it needs to start at the relationship. And so there's always BMIS folks on the land, or tries to be. And just in the last 3 or 4 months, I'm a very, very small role in the complicated web that is Black Mesa Indigenous Support. But it's email. It's basically the main function and like work component of BMIS is folks that are curious about going up and doing direct online support, or have been up and want to be connected with family members. They're going to email BMIS, and someone has to check that and route those questions and answers, and get folks directly up on the land and coordinate transportation and get feedback for what elders and what families still have like current needs and create priority stacks. And so it's definitely a complicated process, but that's pretty much how I got involved.
How has your time been on the land, living on the land with the Dene?
It's been, the first time I went up, I was so surprised, because being raised on and off a reservation myself, I was astounded at the amount of land. For hearing vaguely about this, many of these issues come down to land and like having land taken away. The Flathead Reservation, which is where my great-grandmother is from, she's inland Salish, they don't have any land left. And the reservation is like a matter of miles. It's tiny, it's nothing, it's a trailer park. And the culture, in a sense, has been stripped from the people because they've done, white colonization has done a damn good job of making sure that when my grandmother came back to her reservation that she wouldn't know her cultural practices, that she couldn't speak her own language. I had to tell her she was Salish. You know, she identified as Flathead, which is like a geopolitical issue. It's the name of the lake that's near the reservation. So I was astounded at just the massiveness of the reservation up there. The second astonishment was seeing the mine. And Black Mesa coal mine had been closed and has been closed since 2003 or 2004. And just to see that direct link between the relocation and the mine. And a very outspoken and non-traditional Dene elder, Roberta Blackout, the late Roberta Blackout, describes it as that the coal is the liver of the earth, and the uranium that they mine out of Black Mesa is the lung of the earth, and the water that they use to pipe to slurry line the coal, the 273 mile slurry line, is the blood of the earth. And you contaminate those and you take those off the land, and the earth being a body, the earth gets sick because we're taking out the liver and we're taking out the lungs and we're contaminating the blood. And so it's a very obvious connection, and it's very obvious when you see it with your eyes what's happening to the land. It's very easy for some of the outspoken elders to make those connections as to the current conditions with climate change and the current conditions with pollution and X, Y, and Z. So And it's a lot of hard work. It's a beautiful space, and you can feel the sacredness walking up to like the edge of a canyon, or like even driving up, things get quiet. Things are so vast. There's nowhere to hide, and that's sort of the desert in general. Become very exposed up there, and the real relationship between land and culture, and what that looks like. The beautiful like buildings of the Hogans, like a lot of traditional building that's still up there. And the cornfields, these tough cornfields where these like corn traditionally grows, or grows in when it's not like in the middle of the desert in dry land, very tall, very nimble, kind of flows in the breeze. And up on Black Mesa, you grow corn and you plant 10, and you know, 6 of them goes to the animals, and 2 of them go to the insects, and one of them is for the creator and one of them is for the people. And you plant the seed and then you hope and pray that it comes up, and you pray for that, each one of those seeds. And it doesn't require water. It's so strong and resilient, and it doesn't grow tall because it wouldn't make sense in the desert. It stays low and it bundles down. And it's a very powerful metaphor for like the way of living, that it's the type of like strong, resilient living that it takes to survive up on a place like Black Mesa, and how folks have been able to adapt to like living conditions on Black Mesa, and how it's been such a fight to keep those practices.
Would you have something else to say about anything?
I think that activists and folks that care in the States have a lot to learn. Have been doing a lot, and also have a lot to learn in terms of like ideals of Native fetishism, and how what like the U.S. response to like the Zapatista movement was. It was amazing to see like so many folks rally and be in solidarity with an amazing struggle, and yet these struggles are happening in our backyards, and these struggles are happening on our own land that we're not acknowledging. And looking at Native resistance within North America as a whole, Canada, United States, Mexico, and all the way down into Latin America, and on a global scale. And that, I think, like with any issue, there's an aesthetic quality to the sticker on your backpack, or the sticker on your water bottle, or having the patch on your clothes, but like, what does that mean to you? And how are you participating in that resistance? What attracts you to EZLN? And to simply ask yourself that, and to see if you can be in a space of like acknowledging that privilege, that if folks have privilege, to be able to spend it back. How are you spending it? Are you just keeping it for yourself? It's like, it is a currency, privilege as a currency. And how are we spending it back into our own communities to strengthen those communities and be stronger allies? And don't be afraid to mess up. If everyone's like being in a place of attempting to like be good to one another, then we can only make those bridges stronger. And change is really made by those who show up. So especially within Native resistance, when there are gatherings that are planned, when there are work parties organized, and if you have the privilege to go, like go and show up, and those bridges will be created, and those relationships will be built.
Once again, the BMIS website,
it's blackmesais.org.
Yeah. You have other links that you would like to give for people to like get informed about the struggle?
Yeah, there are actually on the left column of the website, there's a bunch of links with other projects that Black Mesa has been allying with, and they're all up on the website. Yeah.
Well, thanks for that.
Yeah.